Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is Point of View. My name is Pamela Modena. Thank you. We're going to be together until 10 today. Happy Heritage Day, by the way, for those of you who are celebrating today. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear what you got up to. Lots happening in the news today. We're going to be speaking to Thembi Safakude just now, just to talk a little bit about the President's address to the 79th session of the United Nations General Debate. And I thought it was very, very interesting. In fact, earlier on, I spoke to just giving her my take on it. We'll have a chat with Thembisa just now. But we are also going to be speaking to Dr. Sibongile Masuku, who's a senior lecturer in the Cultural and Heritage Studies at the University of Mpumalanga. We're talking about decolonizing the curriculum, not only at universities, but at school level too. So I think it's a very important conversation. And then we'll round off our conversation with Equal Education on that Bella Act. Remember, we started that conversation last week. We couldn't finish it off, and so we'll do that today. And then Sheldon Rochalil will be here to celebrate Heritage Day today as part two of his musical journey with Heritage in South Africa. 2 minutes after eight.
Point of View
on Kaya 959
with Pamela Modene.
What's yours?
Senior Research Fellow at Africa-Asia Dialogue, Thembi Safakude, is on the line with us this evening. Thanks again, Thembi, for making time for us. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your take, just off the cuff, your take on President Cyril Ramaphosa's deliverance of his speech to the 79th session of the United Nations General Assembly?
I think it was a well-structured, well-measured speech. He started by mentioning our successes, the democracy in South Africa, and went on to justify or explain why South Africa took Israel to the ICJ, and went on to promote Africa, particularly the African continental free trade area, which I think is important. He spoke as a statesman, not only for South Africa, but for the entire continent.
Also giving a lot of time to domestic affairs in South Africa, you know, obviously propping up the GNU and the fact that it's something that's working, hopefully will bring foreign investment. And for me, the question is, and I was saying, Thembisa, you know, the speech, I totally agree with you. Very well structured, really good speech. Whether, when you juxtapose the speech to the reality on the ground here, your take on that?
I think, given that he was speaking on international platforms, he had no choice but to speak the way he spoke, because yes, he was addressing the international community.
Yes.
He was not necessarily addressing the South African community. I think he spoke well, and he tried to sell our political stability. But you can see the dovetailing of foreign policy with trade. So I think henceforth South Africa is going to prioritizing economics, going to be prioritizing trade with the rest of the world instead of just only ideology and foreign policy, which at least for the better part of the previous administration has been bogged down into discussing Ukraine, Russia, whether Vladimir Putin will be coming to this country or not, and Palestine. So I think what you are likely to see moving forward is a foreign policy that's going to prioritize trade and economics.
Well, in fact, what I was asking in relation to my question earlier was more the optimism that he was reflecting, whether that seemed accurate to you, that, you know, South Africans are optimistic, everybody's optimistic, we're on the right path.
I think we need to leave that to the academics to come up with some research to tell us precisely where we are at the moment. But 100 days later, I think it is, of the GNU, I think there is a positivity in the country that we are heading towards the right direction. The latest incident of snow in the Drakensberg, at least between Harrismith and Tugela toll gate, it was well handled by the IFP. Many people are happy that it was the IFP that had to handle that. If it was same old government would have been talking a different story. So there is an element of optimism, particularly at institutions such as the Home Affairs and all those that are currently led by other political parties other than the ANC. You see optimism. I know a lot of people are criticizing, for example, the political parties within the GNU that they are over-emphasizing the importance and their role whilst most of these projects were started, initiated by the ANC, but it's them at the moment who are actually taking all the praises and the glory of the culmination of those projects. And we see them much, much more louder every day in terms of what they're doing for the country.
I thought he was very strong on climate change and also calling on developed countries, industrialized nations to take responsibility. I thought that was quite strong of him. Your take on that?
Yes, indeed. And South Africa, of course, has taken a much more bolder step, whether that's good or not. We've gone on to if you ask me, biting more than we can chew in terms of this climate change, notwithstanding, of course, that it, as it correctly put it, it was not us who started this challenge. But we're in the forefront and running with this as if, you know, it was our own doing. I hope it's not going to come back to haunt us, but it's going to bring opportunities. I think South Africa has already signed in and made contracts in terms of transitioning. Whether we're ready or not is another story. But he seemed very confident that we're going to make it, and he's hell-bent at insisting that the world needs to do more in terms of transitioning from fossil fuels into much more clean energy.
He, again, as South Africa has been doing for the past couple of months now, but I mean, as in more vigorously now, calling upon the Security Council to be more democratized, more inclusive. And I thought there was also another very, very strong call by him.
Yeah, but whether we are ready to be part of a club that decides who lives and who dies, I'm a bit skeptical and wary of that. Because, you know, sitting at the UN Security Council means that you have to take much, much more stronger decisions. And some of those decisions could be risky, particularly for a country like South Africa with weaker borders. We know that we've got Somalis and other people. And I'm not saying Somalis are bad people, but I'm saying we have people coming as far as Somalia who walk into South Africa and they'll end up in Johannesburg. Now you're going to be in a platform that decides who gets sanctioned and who get attacked and all of those beautiful things that comes with it and the dangerous things that comes with it. I'm not quite sure whether we are ready for that or any African country for that matter. But again, it's a discussion. It's part of an overall discussion of revamping the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council.
We obviously have many, many other countries still to speak, and it's still day one, it's still early days, but really a big sentiment coming through with Biden, with Jordan, with I think Turkey as well, Gaza being an issue, and of course Biden not chastising Israel, but the sentiment one got so early on was that it is time for somebody to call Israel, you know, to order and do something. And there seemed to be an urgency about that.
Yeah, but it's easy for everybody to say and do so now, because we took a much more stronger stance. We risk a lot in terms of relations and economics and economic relations with the Western countries by taking Israel to the ICJ. Now that it's easier and it's downhill henceforth, we're having more and more of these countries condemning Israel. One wonders, you know, notwithstanding the proximity of these countries, particularly Jordan, Turkey and others, why didn't they amplify their voices when it was not easy? Now it's easy, and I think Cyril Ramaphosa did not really, speak much more seriously about the risk that South Africa took. But again, we're seeing more and more countries now feeling much more comfortable to speak and condemn Israel for its atrocities, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank.
Let's talk about Biden's final address to the UN General Assembly, because this will be his final one. Your take on his speech?
Well, honestly, I think it was a boring speech. It was a speech of a lame duck president. He didn't say much. You expected him to chart a way forward, not only for the United States, but just for multilateralism, democracy, and freedoms that all of us enjoy, and the United States continue to present itself as the defender of those freedoms. He didn't say much. I would have expected a legacy speech, talking much more philosophical than just giving us what we already know. So it was a very flat, boring speech of a lame president. And I wasn't really impressed by it. His condemnation of what's going on, well, a comment on what's going on in the Middle East, particularly in Lebanon and in Gaza and the West Bank, was not at all to my standards, I've expected him to be much more harsher, because he has been. Outside the United Nations and many of the press conferences that I've heard, he has actually been very hard to an extent on Benjamin Netanyahu, really stopping short of condemning Israel for the ongoing atrocities in Gaza and the West Bank.
For me, speaking a little bit in forked tongues, because, you know, obviously calling for people to come back to the drawing board, for negotiations to sign this this peace deal, and you know, for hostages to be returned and so on, but they still continue to fund Israel. It's a bit strange for me in that sense.
America is one country that can actually stop Benjamin Netanyahu tomorrow from the continuing atrocities that we see. But I think what's very important is Israel is isolated. I mean, there's no one so far who came to speak on their behalf. The explanation and the
Oh, Tembisa, I think your line is failing us. I think you may have moved a bit. Please, if you don't mind, just move a little bit more.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Israel is now isolated. The fact that we have that explanation that was given by Cyril Ramaphosa, Turkey and Qatar, in terms of the number of Israelis that were killed and the number of Palestinians that have since been killed, and everybody actually accepting that what happened on October the 7th was wrong in terms of what Hamas did, but at the same time, whether the continuation of bombardment of infrastructure in Gaza and in the West Bank and the killing of thousands of people, journalists, aid workers, etc., is justifiable, really put Israel on the back foot. Israel, I think, will come out of this. We'll have to wait what Benjamin Netanyahu is going to say on the 26th of September, because that's when he's speaking. But for now, Israel is an isolated country, a country that's blamed for possible war in the Middle East, and which could extend to other parts of the world.
I mean, you make a very interesting point and a very good point, because the war is escalating. Now, Israel has moved further north in Gaza. You're seeing what's happening in the West Bank now. I mean, that's quite atrocious, what's happening in Lebanon. And I wonder, with this posture that you spoke of now, Biden's posture, what does that mean then for the Democrats who are going to the elections in the U.S.?
Well, I think Benjamin Netanyahu is relying, of course, on the outcome of the elections in the United States. And he hopes, at least according to many people, that Donald Trump wins, because Donald Trump is likely to support him in his politics and his choice of politics, both in the West Bank, Gaza, and now in Lebanon. I think Benjamin Netanyahu is praying that Kamala Harris doesn't win, because she has made her position clear in terms of what she wants to see, notwithstanding that she continues to promise Israel to present all the wherewithal for them to continue with whatever it takes to continue fighting Hamas and others in the region. So it's a tight situation that will really, by and large, be determined by what happened in November in the U.S. elections. And I think that will really determine the politics, mainly in the United States and in Israel.
Do you think Biden's, you know, tiptoeing around Netanyahu is going to yield some results in the elections as Democrats? Do you think they're going to win or lose this one based on how they've been dealing with Netanyahu?
I think so. I think that's going to determine what's going to be happening. That will determine the outcome of the elections. But by the look of things, Kamala Harris seemed to be steaming ahead, and his favor is being favored by many and touted, at least by now, by the polls and other commentators, that she is likely to win because of Trump's continuing bigotry, the last one about cats and dogs. So we'll have to wait and see. But I think if they continue with the current rhetoric on the politics in the Middle East, you're likely to see the victory of the Democrats.
Tell me, sir, how concerned are you about Lebanon? I'm certainly concerned. How concerned are you about its escalation? This seems to me like it's escalating to levels very, very quickly that are unprecedented.
Well, that's what Hamas, Hezbollah, through Hassan Nasrallah, its leader, that now there was a declaration of war when those pages and other electronic product exploded last week, Tuesday and Wednesday. So Hezbollah is now ready to go all out, supported by Iran and the other axis, including Iraq, Yemen, Hamas, and Hezbollah. You are likely to have a situation getting worse. But importantly, and what people don't talk about much, is that there has been an internal displacement of Israelis both on the southern border and the northern border. Southern border because of the continuing rockets, Qassam rockets that come from Gaza, and in the north, the rockets that are coming from Hezbollah. So there is a chaos inside Israel in terms of displacement. Notwithstanding that, we are all still waiting for those captives to be released from the tunnels in Gaza. You have a war that's going on in the north, and it's likely to intensify. So Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be facing internal pressure, not only from the families of the captives, but also from the internally displaced persons inside Israel.
How much longer do you think he can hold on to this power?
Well, he's going to push the camp down the road until the elections, because that's what he wants. I mean, the pressure that he's currently facing, there is absolutely no way economically that Israel is going to sustain this for any longer without the assistance of the United States. And nor do they have the stamina to be fighting in all fronts. You must remember that you've got the Houthis who are continuing hitting cargo ships going to Israel. You've got Syria, you've got Lebanon. With Hezbollah, you've got Hamas, and you've got Iran and Iraq. The Ayatollah Sistani, who's the largest leader of Shia Islam in the world, has also declared war against Israel. So basically, the entire Middle East or Gulf countries are now saying it has become kosher for all of these countries to attack Israel. So it's unsustainable. There is absolutely no way that this can be sustained, because it's disturbing not only business on the Red Sea, but Israeli airline and flights that bring goods and human beings to and fro Israel is often disturbed, because nobody wants to risk flying airplanes in that airspace that is threatened by all of these parties that I've just mentioned.
I really appreciate your time. Senior Research Fellow at Africa-Asia Dialogues, Thembisa Fakuda. Thank you so much for your time.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.